that the sixth canto was actually following in the subject matter from the fifth canto, because the fifth canto subject matter at the end is the hellish planets, that is where the living entities are tortured for vikarmic activities. So the sixth canto starts with what's called poshana, or protection from the punishment. And we're going to hear about this in the chapter summary. So, of course, chapter 1 is entitled The History of the Life of Jamil. He was a famous person, of course, who got saved because he chanted the names of the Lord in Namabash. That means accidentally, meaning something else, which was his son, Narayan. Okay, so we'll read the chapter summary. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Okay, so the history of the life of Vajramaya. Throughout the Srimad Bhagavatam, there are descriptions of 10 subject matters, including creation, subsequent creation, and the planetary systems. Shukadeva Goswami, the speaker of Srimad Bhagavatam, has already described creation, subsequent creation, and the planetary systems in the third, fourth, and fifth cantos. Now the sixth canto, which consists of 19 chapters, he will describe poshana, or protection, by the Lord. Incidentally, all these different topics, the 10 different topics of what constitute a Purana. Because sometimes people ask, what's the difference between a Purana and Itihas? Itihas means thus it happened. I mean, just the literal meaning of the word, thus it happened. And Purana means old. Just like, of course we don't go around calling people Puranas. Not piranhas, but just like if you go into Radhakund, there's the Purana Mandir in Radhakund, which is, that means the oldest Mandir, and in that Mandir, the deities are there that were discovered by Srila Raghunath Das Goswami when he was excavating the Kundas. It's called the Purana Mandir. So Purana means old. But as far as the Puranas, especially Mahapurana, and there's 18 Mahapuranas, they deal with these 10 subject matters, beginning with creation, subsequent creation, planetary systems, protection, and the mercy of the Supreme Personality of God, and ultimately liberation. So, of course, amongst the 18 Puranas, then you have the Bhagavad Purana, which is called the Amala Purana. Amala means pure. Mala means impurity. Amala means without any impurity. So that because the Bhagavatam only deals with pure devotional service. Although you may think, well, it's describing some people who are in Maya, but it's describing some people in Maya, so we see how either they suffer because they're in Maya, or how they get liberated from Maya and become Krishna conscious. I mean, there's all these stories. For example, you have the story of Pururava, who was very attached to Urvasi in the Srimad Bhagavatam. I don't know if any of you remember that story. A very famous romantic story. Urvasi came down from the heavenly planets. Pururava just like was completely attached to her. Urvasi said, I'll only stay with you if you give me food only cooked in ghee. No canola oil. I never see you naked and you take care of my little pets. And of course she didn't have pet dogs. She had pet lambs. So, Pururava agreed, and one thing led to another, but her lambs were stolen and he was walking around naked to try to retrieve the lambs. And then she saw him naked, and then she went back to the heavenly planets. But then he was just so much immersed in the illusory energy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, he kept meditating on her, began to see her one day a year. That wasn't enough. Then there was an artificial Urvasi that was created, and he wasn't satisfied with her. And then finally he had to perform this whole fire sacrifice to go back home, back to Urvasi. So that's an interesting story for Rurva. So in other words, you have stories of people who are in absolute Maya in the Bhagavatam. But that story just, you know, it's almost a humorous story that shows you the futility and the insanity of being in Maya. You know, punak punas charvita charvananam. You would think that, you know, once he sees Urvasi, all right, you know, seen her, been there, done it, as they say in the material world, that he'd say, all right, you know, I got it out of my system. But it doesn't work like that in the material world. The conditioned soul is so foolish, like an ass, mudha, that he keeps doing the same thing over and over again. And as Albert Einstein said, the symptom of insanity is to think by doing the same thing over and over again, or the same thing, you're going to get a different result. So that's insanity. And that's, material attachment is actually insanity. And just like we experience this insanity practically every day, not because we're attached to Urvasi, but because we're attached to our tongue. You know, think that eating some tasty foods is going to make us happy. Of course, eating prasadam will make us happy, obviously, spiritually. But we're thinking, you know, when, oh, when can that tasty food be given to me? When will it be? Just like a child sometimes is saying to his parents, is it prasadam yet? And, you know, someone is smelling the smell coming from the kitchen, thinking, wow, I can't wait till it's prasadam, I can't wait till this Bhagavatam class is over, then I'll really be happy. So this is going on every day. And we're putting so many things into the body, and they're all becoming transformed into obnoxious substances in the other end. And we're thinking it's going to be different today. Or, you know, there's so many, like, amazing things in the material world. Like we cited the other day, this verse from the Mahabharata, Hani Hani Bhutani Gacchanti Himalayam, that we see everyone else die, and we think, Kimas Charya Taparam. We think that we're not going to die. I mean, that's pretty amazing. So, you know, it's just like the conditioned soul, it's almost like a comedy show. It's almost like a comedy show that he keeps doing the same thing. Sees everybody dies, is dying, nobody's ever achieved happiness or eternality in this material world, and he's thinking it's going to be me. This is called insanity, isn't it? Anyway, so hopefully, just like that one movie, what was the name of that movie? Where someone was living on a movie set his whole life.
Truman Show.
Truman Show. And you know, he was just, every day was the same thing, everybody was actors, as William Shakespeare says, all the, life's a stage, and everyone's a player on the stage. And so, it's like that, and finally he decides to get liberated. It's actually a very good metaphor for the conditioned soul in the material world. He decides to get liberated from the material world. So that's why Maya, or people in Maya, are described in the Srimad Bhagavatam. So, you know, you see the futility. And of course, then there's the everyman story, like Paranjana. The word Paranjana basically means, not directly, but indirectly, every man. Paranjana. The man, you know, the person, every person who was enjoying within the Pura, the city of the nine gates. Navadware Pure Dehi. There's nine gates in this body, and, you know, the two eyes, nostrils, etc. And we're trying to enjoy by going to these nine gates again and again. So really you have these amazing stories of people in absolute Maya. And that, we can identify with that. Hey, that's me. Or the stories of hell. You know, I better not do that, or I'm going there. So a lot of these stories in the Bhagavatam are actually just to bring us to the point of understanding the futility of the material world, the nastiness, or the suffering in the material world, and then later on coming to the protection, the poshana, by the Lord. That's why poshana is here in this particular Canto Srimad Bhagavatam, after the hells, you know, how do you get out of it? Out of this protection? How do you get the protection from the Lord? Okay. And it's told in the story of Ajamil. And Ajamil is also like an everyman story. You know, that people get attached, they think, you know, Ajamil had a very nice wife, as we're going to hear later on, a nice family and nice spiritual master, and he gave it all up because of his sensory attachment and became a dog, a dancing dog, under the control of Maya, in the lap of the witch called Maya. And fortunately, he was saved from all that. Anyway, so we'll continue reading. The first chapter relates the history of Ajamil, who was considered a greatly sinful man, but was liberated when four order carriers of Vishnu came to rescue him from the hands of the order carriers of Yamaraj. A full description of how he was liberated, having been relieved of the reactions of his sinful life, is given in this chapter. Sinful activities are painful both in this life and in the next. In other words, as the sage was benedicting different people, don't live and don't die. You know the story? Prabhupada said, you know, that the sage was benedicting a butcher, and he said, don't live and don't die. He was giving blessings to a brahmachari, and he said, die right away. Because the brahmachari, because he's brahmachari, he goes at least to the heavenly planets if he dies right away. And then, ultimately, for the king was long live the king, because the king was enjoying right now, and then after a while he would have to suffer his sinful activity, so better he just lives for a long time. And then for the devotee is either live or die. It's interesting, isn't it? Either live or dies, because a devotee is enjoying now and he will enjoy in the future. Whereas someone engaged in sinful activities, he's suffering now. Like if you see people at the bars or people, you know, doing all sorts of sinful activities, smoking marijuana, doing all these things, they're suffering. You know, just look in their faces. The face is the index of the mind. Or the eyes are the window to the soul. You ever heard of that before? So if you just look at people's face, it's easy to see if people are suffering. It's not a very difficult thing. And you see these people engaged in sinful life, go into a bar and look in people's faces. Of course, not too close or else they'll get angry with you. And you'll have a fight, you know. You look at your face. What are you staring at my face for? So, sinful life is painful now and painful in the future, whereas devotional service is kevalananda kanda. It is blissful now and also blissful in the future. It's nice. You know, right now, life is nice. As they say, LG, you know, that electronic company, life is good. And in the future, life will be good. Of course, we do have to suffer some of the pains from this body, but at least we have Krishna. Having Krishna makes it all worthwhile. Any sort of austerity, just like when we started, we were talking about this last night, we did a program, that when we started this center here, we did some austerities. That we basically took baths outside in the middle of the winter when it was this cold. It's interesting. And, but we had Krishna. We were understanding it was pleasing. Not taking bath outside is pleasing to Krishna. If I thought it was pleasing to Krishna, I'd still be doing it. But being determined enough to, continue on our service in spite of the impediments, that was what pleasing to Krishna. You understand? Austerities in and of themselves are not pleasing to Krishna. It's not like the Christians in the early days in the medieval times, they would engage in these different tortures. They would self-flagellation. Anyone's heard of that before? Self-flagellation means they hit themselves. In this one movie, The Da Vinci Code, maybe some of you saw that. There was one person who was just like making himself bleed and practically killing himself. And one time I went into, what is it? Oh, Ripley's Believe It or Not in New York. Has anyone been there? Yeah. Ripley's Believe It or Not in New York. No one's been there. So they had, it was very interesting. What they had is like things from the monasteries in the early days. They had the different tortures the monks would subject themselves to. And there were racks. You know what a rack is? There were racks where the monks would actually, stretch, become taller. We call them inversion beds right now. So there were racks, and there were hair shirts, and there were all sorts of different things. I mean, it's just amazing. So it's not that one becomes Krishna conscious by torturing the body. However, if in executing the devotional service, you're very determined, and you have to endure some austerity, then Krishna's pleased with that. In the process of doing your service, then Krishna's pleased with that. Otherwise, austerity for the sake of austerity is not good. Anyway, but when one is doing that, it actually gives one pleasure because one's doing it out of love. Just like if someone is serving their family out of love, it's pleasurable. Because you're just thinking, you're just looking at the picture of your family as you're working hard all day long. And, I mean, just like Ratnagara, interesting story, from the Ramayana, he was doing sinful activities but for the sake of his family, out of love for his family. And, of course, when he was questioned, he thought the family was reciprocating his love. And he went back to his wife and said, would you take some of the karma? She said, hell no. And his children also said, hell no. His daughter and his son. And he said, well, I guess that love was pretty fruitless. And then he basically became a great sage. But really, if someone is doing something out of love, even the austerity becomes pleasurable. Or even if one has a higher objective. I mean, for example, I was talking yesterday with Dear about people who win the marathons, and I say, how much do they make on a marathon? He says, well, what was it, $250,000 or something like that?
Boston
Marathon, $250,000. I was thinking, well, I should start training now. but they're doing it out of love of money, obviously. You know, so somehow or other, they're exercising, doing austerities every day. It's not that they just like wake up one morning and do the marathon, right? They have to. It's not, the rest of the year they're just like eating Fritos or something and donuts and watching TV, and then, it's time for the Boston Marathon, let's go, gang. But every day they're doing hours and hours and hours of exercise, running up mountains, running down mountains, whatever other exercises they do, because it's out of love. And they're thinking of the goal. So that's not really love, but it's we would say a higher taste in the material world, the money. I mean, what can I say? For money, people will do anything in the material world because they have this objective. It's an emotive passion. But in Krishna consciousness, then we're doing this out of love for our guru and love for Krishna, Radha and Krishna. I mean, just like the devotees are doing arti for the deities, and that's, it's austerity, just sitting there waving incense. Especially when the incense makes you choke. So the devotees are sitting there waving incense, and it's an austerity, just stand in the same position, waving incense, even Chintamani falls asleep regularly.
She
yawns, okay. That's a symptom of Mahabhav. it's an austerity, or waking up early in the morning. It's an austerity. I mean, this morning, I woke up early, my regular time, and we went to sleep really late, almost midnight after I got everything done. But then when you're doing it for someone out of love, it's personal, then it actually becomes pleasurable. Even though the body is, saying this, or the mind is saying that, But that's bhakti. Okay. Anyway, so bhakti is always blissful, even if the body and mind are not. You understand? That's bhakti. The body and the mind may be not blissful, because the body and mind can't be blissful or not blissful because they're not sentient. You understand? The body and the mind aren't sentient. We have to get that through our little thick skulls. That the body is not sentient. The soul is sentient. The soul has feelings. The body is simply giving the soul or sending the soul messages from its different sensors. That's all. Like a computer has sensors, or like if you go in the hospital, they'll attach things in your body. There's different sensors and sensors, and you can see the different graphs on the different screens. So that's it. So the body is not sentient. So if we can ignore the messages the body is sending sometimes, you know, body is saying, sleep, sleep. Or the body is saying, eat, eat. You are hungry. You are hungry. You should eat. And the soul says, no. Not 24 hours a day, but the soul says, no, I'm in Bhagavatam class. Isn't it? Sometimes you're sitting and giving class and thinking, I want to eat. So sometimes you just ignore. Not torturing the body, but you just ignore. Because you're the soul. You're not this material body. Anyway, let's see. We should know for certain that the cause of all painful life is sinful action. On the path of fruitive work, one certainly commits sinful activities, and therefore, according to the considerations of karmakanda, different types of atonement are recommended. Such methods of atonement, however, do not free one from ignorance, which is the root of sinful life. Actually, it's interesting that in the Nectar Devotion it describes sin and different types of sin. You know, there's papabija, there's kuta, papabija. Kuta means like the inclination to do something sinful or to ignore Krishna. And bija means the seed of doing a specific sinful activity. You know, there's the karma bija. So anyway, papa bija means the seed. And the seed gets fructified. And when it gets fructified, then you commit the sinful activity, and then you have a mature effect, almost mature effect, and then a mature effect. And then ultimately, you'll get a reaction for that activity, and then after the reaction you get another seed. It's like a vicious circle. You understand? A chain. That's what we say, the chain of karma. Because not only do you get a reaction, let's say I do something really bad today, I go to McDonald's, the Golden Arches. They actually have a good insignia. We should copy them. Anyway, Golden Arches. We go to the I would never do that, obviously. But let's say I do that. Okay. And so then I'll get a reaction. You know, what's the reaction? Well, maybe I'll have to take a cow birth for every hair on that cow that the meat came from. A pretty big reaction. But in addition, there's the reaction that my material desires increase. I get the seed of sinful life to do more sin. So not only do you get the external reaction from a sinful act, but you get the impetus to do more of that act. It's pretty heavy, isn't it? So therefore, atonement doesn't free you. Like atonement in the Christian church would be confession, or Catholic churches, confession. Atonement in the Jewish temple would meet one day a year. It's called Yom Kippur, for those of you who want to become Jewish. And you go and you atone for one day. You go to the temple and you say, forgive me, God. All these different prayers in Hebrew. It's really interesting. And you say, you know, please forgive me the sins I did. But it doesn't purify your heart because the sinful desire seed is still there. You still have the inclination to do all those things. And that's the problem. Like you see, I mean, for example, like you see people like priests and other religious people engage in sinful life so many times because the inclination is there. Recently, there was one nun in Rome, in Italy, and then she came back. She went on vacation. She was from South America. She went on vacation to visit her parents, and she came back to to Italy, and he discovered she was going to become a mother. Did anyone hear about that? No. That's the advantage of me reading the news. You can use these stories in Bhagavatam class. So anyway, so the inclination, and there's nothing wrong with being a mother, but for a nun to become a mother, that's something wrong with that. Because they've taken vows. You know, when you've taken a vow to do something, then you better stick to your vow. So, because the inclination was still there. And so as soon as she was exposed to her, you know, previous boyfriend or whatever, then the activities manifested themselves. Therefore, atonement doesn't work. Or self-flagellation, or doing whatever you're doing to try to get rid of the sinful desire doesn't work. The only process is actually frying the desire seed, which is done with the chanting of Hare Krishna. Consequently, Prabhupada said, one is prone to commit sinful activities even after atonement, which is therefore very inadequate for purification. On the path of speculative knowledge, one becomes free from sinful life by understanding things as they are. Therefore, the acquirement of speculative knowledge is also considered a method of atonement. But still, the heart doesn't become purified by speculative knowledge. Or even knowing that you're not the body. It doesn't purify you. Or even knowing that you're a servant of Krishna doesn't purify you until you act in that capacity. You understand? You could say, I'm a servant of Krishna, but you act as a servant of your senses. While performing fruitive activities, one can become free from the actions of sinful life through austerity, penance, celibacy, control of the mind and senses, truthfulness, and the practice of mystic yoga. By awakening knowledge, one may also neutralize sinful reactions. Neither of these methods, however, can free one from the tendency to commit sinful activities. This is the real point. By bhakti yoga, one can completely avoid the tendency for sinful life. Other methods are not very feasible. Therefore, the Vedic literature concludes that devotional service is more important than the methods of karmakanda and jnanakanda. Only the path of devotional service is auspicious for everyone. Fruitive activities and speculative knowledge cannot independently liberate anyone, but devotional service independent of karma and jnana is so potent that one who has fixed his mind at the lotus feet of Krishna is guaranteed not to meet the Yamadutas, the order carriers of Yamaraj, even in dreams. So, if we're meeting the Yamadutas in dreams, that means we're not fixed in devotional service. Or our mind is not fixed at the lotus feet of Krishna. So, to prove the strength of devotional service, Srila Shukadeva Goswami described the history of Ajamil. Ajamil was a resident of Kanya Kubja, the modern Kanauji. He was trained by his parents to become a perfect Brahmin by studying the Vedas and following the regulative principles. But because of his past, this youthful Brahmana was somehow attracted by a prostitute. And because of her association, he became most fallen and abandoned all regulative principles. Ajamil begot in the womb of the prostitute 10 sons, the last of whom was called Narayana. At the time of Ajamil's death, when the order carriers of Yamaraj came to take him, he loudly called the name Narayana in fear because he was attached to his youngest son. Thus he remembered the original Narayana, Lord Vishnu. Although he did not chant the holy name of Narayana completely offenselessly, it acted nevertheless. As soon as he chanted the holy name of Narayana, the order carriers of Lord Vishnu immediately appeared on the scene. A discussion ensued between the order carriers of Lord Vishnu and those of Yamaraj, and by hearing that discussion, Ajamil was liberated. He could then understand the bad effect of fruitive activities and could also understand how exalted is the process of devotional service. So, of course, just to finish up the discussion, Ajamil heard the name of Narayana in what's called the stage of Nama Bash. Nama Bash means like a reflection, and sometimes there's distorted reflection, an actual reflection. In the Harinam Chintamani, written by Bhaktivinoda Thakur, which discusses this in a in the context of a discussion between Haridas Thakur and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. The Namavasa is actually elaborated on, and it's described by Haridas Thakur that even inanimate living entities can hear the name in Namavas. He describes that when there's an echo, let's say if you're having a kirtan and there's an echo, that echo is the kirtan of the inanimate living entities. Inanimate means even the living entities in the atoms. And there's living entities everywhere. Even Prabhupada described it, a cloud is a living entity. That may be shocking to some of you. A cloud is a living entity because it undergoes the process of, let's say, birth, growth, maintenance, byproducts, dissolution, and death, these six changes. And so even a cloud or an atom is a living entity in, of course, an unconscious state. So when you chant, then all these living entities make spiritual progress. And therefore, by the loud chanting, then every living entity is able to hear. So Haridas Thakur, he would engage sometimes in chanting his japa loudly. Of course, he would chant some of his rounds just in his mind. Because he was chanting, a lot of rounds every day. Not just 64. 3 times 64. It's a lot of rounds, isn't it? 192 rounds a day. And so he would chant, I think, one group of 64 he would chant mentally. And the other ones. But he would chant very loudly, so the living entities would be liberated by hearing that. And then, of course, the perfect example of that is when the prostitute approached Haridas Thakur, and she heard the holy name, and she just repeated the holy name, this is Namavas. And even she had some, let us say, offensive attitude. I mean, her offensive attitude was that she was attempting to cause Haridas Thakur to fall down. Even though she had an offensive attitude, by hearing the name in Namavas, she actually became liberated. So much so that she gave up her business. Liquidated all of her assets. That doesn't mean her body, but she liquidated all of her monetary jewelry assets, gave them to brahmanas, and then shaved her head and just became a pure devotee of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. It's interesting, isn't it? So that's the potency of Namavasa is like that. And of course, Haridas Thakur was describing in the assembly house of the Majumdras how Namavas frees one from karma, past, present, future, prarabdha karma, which means even the karma that maintains your body. And devotees sometimes ask, we're freed from this prarabdha karma, how is our body maintained? And Prabhupada answered that Krishna personally maintains the body of a devotee. It's no longer your karma maintaining it. Of course, you have a token reaction, which is to remind you of your previous karma and to help purify you, and that token reaction is directly administered by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. But simply by chanting like that, all karma goes away. You don't have to worry about karma, and you shouldn't really get into your horoscopes that much. I know devotees, they really get into it so many times. I remember one year, even we planned out the GBC meeting according to certain Mahurtas, and we couldn't even enter the meeting room until it got to the exact second when we were supposed to enter the meeting room. I mean, it was insane, actually. I hate to say that. We were just like locked out of the meeting room, and so if they were counting 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, okay, go! For the start of the meeting. And that meeting was one of the least productive meetings we ever had. Maybe Krishna was telling us something. Even though all the astrologers had said it was going to be extremely productive, it wasn't productive at all. So we've been chanting the holy names. Prabhupada said, Krishna, by the tip of his toe, can kick away millions or unlimited numbers of Rahu planets. Rahu and Ketu planets, which are the malefic planets. So we don't worry so much about it. I mean, sometimes devotees get all these like mystic things. And it almost it's like, you know, it just gets, I can't relate. It's like I've joined another movement after Prabhupada. It's like after Prabhupada left the movement, I mean, just a devotee snapping their fingers every time they yawn. It's just like, you know, what's happening? You know, Prabhupada taught us, you know, the KISS philosophy, keep it simple, sadhu. You know, chant Hare Krishna, believe in Krishna, Krishna will make everything auspicious, preach Krishna consciousness. But we've made Krishna consciousness something different than what Prabhupada gave us. He made it much more complicated, beginning with the deity worship and the rituals. I mean, even the prasadam prayer that people say was not the prasadam prayer Prabhupada taught us. You know, he taught us part of it, Sharira Vijaja, but the other one, Prabhupada never taught that. I don't even know where it came from.
Which part?
You know, Sarva, what I forget. I don't even know how to say it because I never learned it. The other one people say, you know the one? Yeah, Mahaprasadam Govinda. Prabhupada never taught us that. Where did it come from? I don't even know where it came from. Prabhupada taught us to chant, you know, oh Lord, this material body is a place of ignorance and the senses are networks of paths leading to death. But you, Lord Krishna, are very kind to us. And all the senses, the tongue is the most voracious, uncontrollable. And you, Lord Krishna, are very kind to us. You have given us prasadam, mahaprasadam, to help us control the tongue. So now that, let us take this prasadam and love call out for Lord Chaitanya, Lord Nityananda. So we add a lot of things. I mean, like I say, I don't even know half the rituals that people do nowadays. Because I just learned from what Prabhupada did. So we make it more sophisticated. And we also, by making it more sophisticated, we also separate ourselves from potential people who could become Krishna conscious. Prabhupada's presentation of Krishna consciousness for us Westerners was very, very down to earth and basic. I mean, it just, you didn't have to learn all the mudras. I mean, I probably never did mudras. I never saw Prabhupada like doing this, you know, or anything like that. Very simple. You know, you see the original films of Prabhupada. Prabhupada did this thing called Bells in the Morning, which is a little RT. You know, you've seen those films. And it was just simple. You know, Krishna consciousness is very easy. You join the movement, you're not the body, read Bhagavad Gita, go on Sankirtan, chant the holy names, Hare Krishna, go back to Godhead, read Krishna book. It's become something so sophisticated that anyway, and even Prabhupada's Bhakti Shastri exam was just like 11 or 12 questions. You know, who is Krishna? You know, why is it you understand he's the Supreme Personality of Godhead? It wasn't you had to learn 10,000 verses from millions of Shastras. And it was something like easily digestible for people. You understand? Okay. That was almost a Krishna West advertisement. Almost. Not quite. So, anyway, tomorrow we'll go on to the first verse. All glories to the divine grace.